She said there was something she wanted to get off her chest.
What did she tell you? Calvin reached for the letter Virginia had shared with him.
Everything she wrote right here. It was not a quick phone call. Talked almost an hour, as I recall. She told the whole story.
What did you do?
I listened, took notes. Then when the call was over, I typed it all up.
Do you still have those notes?
No, sir. I sent them to the governor's office.
Why there?
I knew there'd be no justice in Live Oak. So I wrote to the governor. Bad mistake.
I presume it went nowhere, said Jack. Calvin shook his head.
Worse than that. They must have come down on Cynthia like a ton of bricks.
Did she withdraw her statement? He nodded slowly, an empty expression in his eyes.
I spoke to Cynthia one more time after that. I can't remember if I called her or she called me, but I won't forget her words. She said, "You and I never talked. Leave it be." And that was the end of it.
There was no investigation?
No. One of our local NAACP officers in Mims tried to get something going. There was talk of going to the Justice Department, but this was years before the Civil Rights Movement. No federal jurisdiction. Nothing ever came of it.
Did you ever tell anyone about it?
Sure did. Just about everybody I told is dead now. Even Jamal.
You told Jamal about Willie James?
Yes, sir.
Jack wished he would stop calling him sir. How did that come about?
I was in Gainesville to see him sworn in as Alpha President. Afterward, I sat down with him and Brandon.
Brandon Wall?
That's right. Brandon was the outgoing president. Jamal was the new one. I wanted to tell them how proud I was of both of them and how important it is for black fraternities to have leaders like them. You know, there's folks who say the Divine Nine are a thing of the past. Used to be that black fraternities produced all our important leaders. Martin Luther King. Thurgood Marshall. That's changing. Barack and Michelle Obama, Obama's attorney general, the last three black men elected to the U.S. Senate, not one of them was in a black Greek letter organization.
How did that conversation lead to Willie James?
At some point, Brandon asked me, "How do you feel about the president of a black fraternity having a white girlfriend?"
He meant Jamal.
When he asked the question, I didn't know if he meant Jamal or himself. But it wouldn't have changed my answer.
What did you say?
I told them I felt no different than I would about any black man with a white girlfriend. I said, be careful. See, when you get to my age and you realize how fast the years pass, it really isn't that long ago that a black man could be lynched over a white woman. So I told them about Willie James.
You told both Jamal and Brandon?
Yes, I did.
When was that?
September. Not but 2 months ago.
Calvin's gaze drifted away. Jack couldn't tell if the old man was taking a moment to remember that time, not but 2 months ago, when his great-grandson was alive with so much to live for, or if he was just getting tired.
Do you have any more questions, Mr. Switek?
asked Virginia. Her clear implication was that it was time to leave Calvin alone. Jack rose and thanked him. Virginia asked if there was anything Calvin needed before they left, but he assured her that he didn't. He was sharing the suite with his nephew, who would put him to bed upon returning from dinner.
"I don't know what you intend to do about all this," said Calvin. "But I'm hoping I did the right thing."
Jack shook his hand and said, "You did." Chapter 77. Andy rode past midnight nonstop until they reached the river. There were 8 in her group, including herself and Agent Ferguson. Andy took comfort in knowing that the GPS chip in her transmitter kept their FBI contact apprised of their exact location.
"We need a boat," said Colt.
Andy hoped that the tech agent monitoring her body wire transmissions caught that remark. Confirmation arrived in less than 30 seconds.
"Let's head this way," Ferguson told the group. "There's private property upriver. We can probably borrow a boat."
Everyone knew what he meant by borrow. Only Andy knew that his intelligence had come directly from their FBI contact. Agents were in the area, and it made Andy feel safer to know that the team would swoop in if something went wrong. But she also understood that time was running out for her to get one of these Alliance members to say something solid to implicate Stager in the abduction of Percy Donovan.
"What do we do with the bikes?" asked William.
"Paulette can stay here and watch them," said Colt. He meant Andy.
"No," said Ferguson. "She goes with me."
"I'll stay," said one of the old guys. "My back's killing me anyway."
The group of 7 set off heading up the pathway along the river. Ferguson's intelligence had been spot on. In less than 5 minutes, they came upon a house and private property. A flats boat was moored to a pier that jutted out into the river.
"Bingo," said Colt.
Andy went with the flow. Technically speaking, an undercover agent's participation in a felony, grand larceny, required prior approval. This one had to fall under the exigent circumstances exception. They climbed aboard. Colt made short work of the combination lock and pushed away from the pier. The current carried them downriver, and when they were far enough away from the owner's house, Colt started the engine. Soon they were at full throttle, throwing a V-shaped wake against the riverbanks. The tall cypress trees were mere silhouettes, their moss-clad limbs barely visible against the starlit sky. A thin blanket of fog stretched across the river. The speedboat cut through it like a laser through cotton candy. Suddenly, Colt killed the engine. The boat drifted silently downriver.
"Listen," he said.
There was a hum in the air.
"Is that another boat?" asked William.
"Or a helicopter," said Colt. "Cops must be searching. They must know he escaped."
"Who?" asked Andy. She was trying to get him to say Percy, but her question was answered only with a suspicious glare.
"The boogeyman," said Colt.
"Should we turn back?" asked William.
"No,"
said Colt, still looking at Andy.
"We keep going, and we find the boogeyman before they do."
Chapter 78. Jack was in the courtroom early, well before the Arthur hearing was scheduled to reconvene. Brandon Wall was shaping up to be the hearing's most important witness. Jack had worked late into the night preparing for his cross-examination. He understood that tone would be as important as substance, and he hoped that his early arrival, while things were relatively quiet, would help his thoughts gel. Oliver Bolt arrived early as well, He walked straight to Jack's side of the courtroom and laid the crime lab's final report on the table in front of him.
Testing on the croc is completed, said Bolt.
What's the bottom line? Asked Jack.
No DNA match to Mark Towson or Bane Robinson.
Jack played it cool, as if he'd known all along that no other result was possible. Whose DNA is it?
We don't know. It's obviously someone whose DNA isn't in any available database.
That wasn't bad news, but it wasn't the case-breaking development that Jack had hoped for. Do you plan to introduce the report into evidence, or shall I? Asked Jack.
I've already delivered it to Judge Teague's chambers, along with a letter explaining how these findings are consistent with our theory of the case.
Consistent with your theory?
Yes, Bolt said with a completely straight face. It has been my suspicion all along that there was a third conspirator in the lynching of Jamal Cousin.
There's no allegation of a third conspirator in your indictment, said Jack.
That will change if and when the third conspirator is identified. Until then, we will proceed against your client on the assumption that there is an unindicted co-conspirator.
Bolt turned and walked to his table. Jack opened the report. The DNA test results were obviously helpful to the defense, no matter how Bolt tried to spin them to Jack, the media, or the judge. But Bolt was right not to panic. It was common for conspiracy cases to proceed against a named defendant and his unidentified, unnamed partners in crime. Jack opened the written report. The most important matter at hand was the cross-examination of Brandon at 9 a.m., but he had time to skim. The results were as the prosecutor had stated. What Jack had found almost as interesting, however, was the introductory section of the report. It was standard for an examiner to explain how the croc had been located, collected, and taken to the lab for testing. Jack had been aware that it was a group of volunteers from the Divine Nine that had found the croc and alerted the police. Until now, however, until seeing the name in black and white in the forensic report, Jack had been unaware of the exact fraternity brother who had actually found the croc. It surprised him at first. But then his thoughts, which had been so unsettled all night, finally started to fall into place. I'll be damned, he said, reading the name one more time. It was Brandon Wall. Chapter 79. Percy was deep in chilly river water. It was high tide or close to it. Percy had found the strength to swim ashore, but the soggy bank that was his refuge had slowly disappeared beneath the rising river. He needed higher land, or he could die of hypothermia. Percy tried to stand, but couldn't. It wasn't just exhaustion. The leg wound from the buckshot was worse than he'd first thought. He'd tied his shirt around his thigh to try to stanch the bleeding, but he was still losing blood, his life draining out of him. Not gonna die. Not here. Not now. Percy floated on his belly, moving like an alligator toward a log on the flooded riverbank. His hand stirred up the sediment below, but he couldn't really feel anything. His fingertips had gone numb. He made it to the log and stopped, searching for the strength to pull himself up. It was dark beneath the leafy canopy, but Percy could see patches of sky. The stars were fading. The glow of sunrise was near. If he could slither like a gator, he could sun himself atop a log like one, too. He reached up, grabbed hold of a knot in the fallen cypress, and then stopped. He heard something. A whining in the distance. A boat? He listened more intensely. The steady noise was from upriver, Had it been from downriver, his spirits would have soared. Upriver could mean one of two things. Rescue, or recapture. First things first. Survival. He pulled with every ounce of strength, and the exertion made his leg throb as if he'd been shot all over again. But he worked through the pain, straining in the darkness, and managed to rest his chest atop the log. He lay there for a moment, legs dangling into the water, his body soaking wet. The night air was colder than the water, but he had faith that the sun would rise again. He had faith. The whining noise grew louder. His expenditure of energy just climbing onto the log had left his mind fuzzy. He struggled to focus. The sound was unmistakable. A motor. Definitely a boat. He found the strength to turn his head, his right cheek atop the cypress bark, and one eye on the river. He didn't know if the police were looking for him. But if it was a police boat or a park ranger, he would call out to them. If he could find a voice. Hang on. Percy lay perfectly still, fighting to keep his eyes and ears open as the boat drew closer. Chapter 80.
Mr. Swiatek, said the judge, you may proceed with cross-examination of the witness. Mr. Wall, you are reminded that you are still under oath.
The courtroom was silent as Jack Rosen approached. Less than 24 hours had passed since Brandon's testimony. The courtroom was just as packed, and the tension was equally high. But so much had changed, at least from Jack's perspective. Not only about the case, but also the way he saw Brandon Wall. The transformation had started with the prosecutor's final line of questions when Brandon had identified Mrs. Towson as the reason Shelley and Jamal had kept the relationship a secret. Since Jack's meeting with Kelvin Cousin, little things had been falling into place and the picture continued to come clear as he stepped toward the witness.
Good morning, Mr. Wall, he said cordially.
Morning, said Brandon.
You were the president of the Alpha House last year, correct?
Yes.
You're very proud of being an Alpha.
I am.
You're proud of the traditions and values of the Alpha fraternity.
Of course.
As a former president, you feel an obligation to uphold those traditions and values.
Yes.
Is it fair to say that you think other Alpha brothers have the same obligation?
That's a fair statement.
That's especially true if we're talking about the president of the fraternity.
I suppose.
The president should lead by example. Do you agree?
Yeah, sure.
You would agree that one of those values is truthfulness. An Alpha president should be truthful.
The prosecutor rose.
Objection, Your Honor. The witness has already sworn to tell the truth, so I don't see the point of any of this.
Jack looked at the judge and said,
He will see the point, Your Honor.
Overruled, the judge said. The witness may answer.
Yes, an Alpha president should be truthful, said Brandon. Yesterday, Mr. Bolt asked you if you had ever told anyone about the relationship between Jamal Cousin and Shelley Towson. You answered never. That was your testimony, correct?
I believe so.
Jack turned and slowly walked toward the rail.
Kelvin Cousin was seated at the end of the first row, behind the prosecutor's table. With his gaze, Jack guided Brandon's line of sight in Kelvin's direction. You've met Jamal's great-grandfather, Kelvin Cousin, have you not, Mr. Wall? Brandon glanced in the old man's direction, acknowledging him.
I have.
You met when Jamal was sworn in as the new president, correct?
Yes.
He spoke privately to you and Jamal and said how proud he was of you as Alpha Presidents, is that right?
Yes, something like that.
He told you how important it was that young men like you were continuing the traditions and values of the Alpha Fraternity.
Jack glanced again at Kelvin as if sending a message to Brandon.
He did, said Brandon.
At some point in that same conversation, you asked him how he would feel about the Alpha President dating a white woman. You asked him that question, right?
Brandon didn't answer right away. Again, Jack cut a glance in Kelvin's direction, sending the message to Brandon.
I believe I did ask him that question, said Brandon.
Kelvin expressed some concern about it, did he not?
Yes, but his concern was that dating a white woman might not be as safe as we thought it was.
Let's talk about that a little more, said Jack. Does the name Willie James Howard mean anything to you, Mr. Wall?
The prosecutor rose as if shot from a cannon.
Objection, Your Honor. This is going way beyond the scope of direct examination, and I can't see how it has any relevance to this case.
Jack detected a hint of urgency in the prosecutor's voice.
Judge, I'm not sure how Mr. Bolt would know if it's relevant, even before we've established who Willie James Howard is, said Jack.
The prosecutor looked pale. Judge, may we discuss this in your chambers, please? Judge Teague seemed confused by the request, but Bolt's demeanor and tone of voice made it clear that if the state attorney's years of service to the people of Suwanee County meant anything, Judge Teague would grant him this favor.
All right, the judge said. Counsel in my chambers.
The judge stepped down from the bench, and the courtroom waited in silence as the lawyers followed him into his chambers. Over the next 10 minutes, the story of Willie James Howard unfolded. Oliver Bolt denied any awareness of it. It was Jack's impression that he denied it a little too forcefully.
Judge, we don't even know if this Willie James actually existed, Bolt said finally. The story could be nothing but a story.
The judge pondered it.
Mr. Swiatek, really, what is the point of dredging up all this history?
Your Honor, Jack started to say, but Bolt cut him off.
Clearly, Mr. Swiatek's point is that just about anybody could have lynched Jamal Cousin because we're all a bunch of racists here in North Florida. I suppose the next thing we'll see from him and his friends in Miami is a warrant to search Your Honor's closet for a white robe and a cross-burning kit.
That's not my point at all, said Jack.
Judge Teague raised his arms like a boxing referee, silencing the lawyers.
Here's my decision. At this point, I will allow Mr. Swiatek to establish that Kelvin Cousin told Brandon Wall and Jamal Cousin a story about a black teenager who was lynched for sending love letters to a white girl. Beyond that, Mr. Swiatek, I'm keeping you on a short leash. I will not allow you to turn this hearing into a racial indictment of Live Oak in the 1940s. Is that clear?
Jack clung to the fact that the judge had prefaced his ruling with the words, at this point, there was work to do. But if the cross-examination of Brandon Wall proceeded as hoped, Jack was confident that Judge Teague would come around, even if Oliver Bolt did seem to deny the very existence of Willie James Howard.
It's clear, Judge, said Jack. Chapter 81. The river glistened with the first glint of the morning sun. Percy saw the flats boat approaching. It was white. So were the men on board. Percy felt his pulse quicken. He no longer had the full cover of night. He wondered if they could see him lying atop the log along the riverbank. The engine ceased. There was silence.
"What the fuck is that?"
asked one of the boaters, his voice carrying all the way to Percy. Percy didn't move. He lay there, motionless, and watched. The boat was in daylight, but Percy was in the forested wetland, still shrouded in pre-dawn semi-darkness. Suddenly a spotlight hit him straight in the eyes, blinding him. The beam swept his body from head to toe and then back again.
"Well," the man said, "if that ain't the ugliest fucking gator I ever did see."
Percy pushed himself off the log and splashed into the cold swamp below. The spotlight followed him. The engine restarted. Percy could touch bottom, but he couldn't run. He half swam and half walked, trying to escape. The boat drew closer. The spotlight bore down on him like a falling meteor.
"Hard to port!"
the skipper shouted. Percy was getting nowhere, worse than nowhere. He was chest deep in water, knee deep in muck. The boat was nearly on him. A rope hit him in the face. A lasso closed around his neck.
"Got him!"
"Freeze, FBI!"
Andy shouted. She was aboard the boat, her pistol aimed at Colt's chest. Ferguson drew his weapon, too.
"You're surrounded by law enforcement," said Andy.
"That's so," said Colt. "Then where the fuck are they?"
Andy was beginning to wonder the same thing, but she didn't flinch.
"Are you Percy Donovan?"
she shouted, plenty loud for Percy to hear her.
"Yeah!"
"Go ahead and take that rope off your neck. Are you hurt?"
"Yeah,"
said Percy as he removed the lasso.
"Got shot in the leg. I'm bleeding."
Andy repeated his words to make sure Percy's condition was transmitted by her body wire.
"We'll need medical," she continued, but suddenly the engine roared and the boat lunged forward. Ferguson tumbled overboard with the four other men at the bow. Another tackled Andy, her gun discharged, and he went down with a thud. Colt came at her. The fight for her weapon was a rematch of the campsite free-for-all as the boat sped straight down the river with no one behind the wheel.
Chapter 82. The courtroom was equal parts media and general public as Judge Teague led the lawyers from his chambers. Jack took his position in front of the witness, and the state attorney returned to his seat at the prosecutor's table. The judge explained his decision from the bench.
"Mr. Wall, you are allowed to answer the following question. Did Calvin Cousin tell you and Jamal about the alleged lynching of a black teenager named Willie James Howard?"
Brandon leaned closer to the microphone and said,
"Yes, he did."
Bolt rose.
"Just to clarify the record, Your Honor, am I correct in saying that the court is not accepting this testimony as proof that a man named Willie James Howard was actually lynched?"
"That's correct," the judge said. "The testimony is admitted only to show that the witness heard the story."
Jack searched the gallery and found Kelvin. He'd struck Jack as an even-tempered man in their meeting, but it had clearly angered him that the judge and the prosecutor had reduced the murder of Willie James Howard to a story. Jack continued,
"Mr. Wall, what Mr. Cousin told you about Willie James Howard scared you, didn't it?"
"I'd say it opened our eyes," said Brandon.
But it didn't stop Jamal from seeing Shelley Towson, did it?
No.
You worried about Jamal, didn't you?
A little?
You worried not only because Jamal was black, but also because he was the president of the Alpha House, a black fraternity, right?
That was part of it.
But the biggest reason to worry, and I want you to be totally honest, speaking as a former Alpha president, wasn't your biggest worry of all the fact that Shelley Towson's brother was the president of the Theta House?
I don't think that really mattered.
It had mattered, Jack was sure of it. He just needed to find a way to get the witness to admit it. Jack retrieved the transcript from Mark's disciplinary hearing. Mr. Wall, you were a witness at Mr. Towson's student conduct hearing at the University of Florida, were you not?
I was.
You told the committee about the time that Bain Robinson hired you to serve as bartender at a fraternity party, am I right?
I did.
You quit before the party started, right?
Yes.
You quit because Mr. Robinson wanted you to serve a cocktail made with watermelon liqueur, a drink called Strange Fruit.
Yes.
You quit because you thought it was racist, correct?
I think almost anyone would see it as racist, said Brandon.
Agreed, said Jack. And still another reference to Strange Fruit came in the text message we've heard so much about. Can we agree that was a racist message?
Absolutely.
And Jamal told you that he'd received two other messages just like it. One from Theta brother Bain Robinson and the other from Theta brother Cooper Bartlett, correct?
Yes.
Mr. Wall, is it fair to say that after those messages, you'd heard and seen enough to believe that the brothers of the Theta Pi Omega fraternity were racists?
At least some of them, definitely.
And even though you believed the Theta brothers were racists, you knew that Jamal Cousin was not going to stop seeing Shelley Towson. Isn't that right, Mr. Wall?
I don't think I knew that.
Well, let's go back to your testimony from yesterday, said Jack. Jamal asked you to make sure all the Alpha brothers went on the tubing trip down the Itchituckney so that Jamal could be alone in the house with Shelley Towson. That was your testimony, right?
Brandon squirmed a little, but it was in the transcript, undeniable.
Right? So you knew that the president of the Alpha House was going to continue to see Shelley Towson, right?
Yeah, I knew.
And you believed that Shelley's brother had sent a racist text to Jamal.
Right.
And you believed that her brother's friends had sent a racist text to Jamal.
Right.
And you had not forgotten that Bain Robinson had asked you to serve strange fruit cocktails at a frat party, had you?
No, I didn't forget.
Jack paused, but only for effect.
You had a problem with that. Didn't you, Mr. Wall?
I don't know if... Objection! I'll rephrase, said Jack. Jamal Cousin, the president of the most prestigious black Greek letter organization on campus, was dating a white woman whose brother was the president of a racist fraternity. As a former Alpha president, you had a problem with that, didn't you, Mr. Wall?
I didn't like it.
You wanted the relationship to end, didn't you?
I would have preferred it if Jamal stopped seeing her, yeah.
That was good enough. Jack had established the platform he needed to launch the final strike. A week after the text messages, Jamal Cousin's body was found on the Itchituckney River, correct?
That's my understanding.
That's all I'm asking for, Mr. Wall, is your understanding. In fact, I'd like to compare your understanding of what happened to Jamal Cousin to what Calvin Cousin told you about Willie James Howard.
Judge, said Bolt, groaning, I object to this overruled.
Judge Teague seemed to understand where Jack was headed. Jack took it as a green light. Right before his death, said Jack, Willie James Howard wrote love letters to a white girl. Correct?
That's what Mr. Cousin told us.
Jamal had a white girlfriend at the time of his death, correct?
Yes.
The men who murdered Willie James took him to the river.
Right.
Jamal was found on the river.
Yes.
The men who murdered Willie James bound his hands and feet. Hog-tied him, right?
Yes.
Jamal was also hog-tied.
I don't...
You know that, said Jack, allowing no wiggle room. You've seen those awful photographs, have you not?
Yes, I've seen them.
Willie James was thrown in the river and drowned?
Yes.
Jamal Cousin may or may not have drowned.
I don't know. I think you do.
Objection, said Bolt. That one is sustained, the judge said.
Brandon was in desperate need of a break, but Jack forged ahead. He went to his table and retrieved the crime lab report he'd received from the state attorney that morning. He was down to his last round of ammunition.
Mr. Wall,
you were part of a civilian search party that went looking for Percy Donovan after his disappearance, were you not?
I was.
You didn't find Percy, but you did find a foam resin shoe, correct?
I did.
Jack handed the report to the witness, not for him to read it, but just to set up his question. Would it surprise you to hear that a forensic examination confirmed that the shoe you found is the mate to the foam resin shoe that was found near Jamal's body?
I don't know how to answer that.
Jack took the report back from him. Mr. Wall, how big an area did you and the other volunteers search?
There were two teams on each side of the river. We walked a couple of miles, I'd say, maybe more.
How many volunteers were there?
Maybe 75.
So there were 75 volunteers searching 4 linear miles of riverbank, and it was you who happened to find the shoe. Is that right?
Yeah.
You zeroed right in on it, I guess.
I found it.
Jack took a step closer, his gaze tightening.
You found it because you knew it was there.
Brandon swallowed hard.
That's not true.
You found it right where you lost it, on the night of Jamal's death.
That's absurd.
Objection. Sustained.
Jack handed the report to the witness, this time opening it to the appropriate page. Look at page 5 of the report, Mr. Wall. This croc wasn't found in black water. The environmental conditions that destroyed all DNA in the first croc didn't exist. This one, the mate you found, has DNA on it. Do you see where it states that in the report?
Brandon studied the page. The report shook in his hand.
Brandon, said Jack, deliberately using his first name in a softer tone.
Should I hire a scientist to test your croc for your DNA? Or do you want to tell us the truth here and now?
Brandon stared at the report, his hand shaking. The prosecutor could have objected, but there was only silence. As if everyone in the courtroom knew that the truth was nigh.
Brandon, said Jack, nudging a little more. You found the croc because if you didn't, one of those 75 other volunteers would.
Did you think it would look better if you found it?
Or did you think you could explain why your DNA was on it by saying that you touched it when you found it? Finally, Brandon looked up, his voice quaking.
He suffocated.
Jamal suffocated? He nodded, looking past Jack as he spoke, a vacant expression in his eyes.
We were just trying to scare him. When I opened the trunk, Jamal was dead.
An alpha brother jumped to his feet in the crowd.
Brandon, don't!
Judge T gaveled down the interruption and then spoke directly to the witness.
Mr. Waugh, under the Constitution of the United States, you have no further obligation to answer Mr. Swiatek's questions. You have the right to say nothing until you've consulted with legal counsel.
Jack heard what the judge was saying, but he stood dumbfounded, as his own interpretation of a night gone terribly wrong played out like a movie in his mind. A blindfolded Jamal with his mouth taped shut, the Alpha brothers shoving him in a stuffy trunk, the hour-long car ride to the river, the trunk popping open and Brandon's horrified discovery that Jamal had suffocated, the panic over a possible arrest and prison sentence for all the brothers involved, not to mention the disgrace to befall the Alpha House. And someone, Brandon, coming up with a surefire way to divert law enforcement's attention from any involvement of a black fraternity. A staged lynching, inspired by the true story of Willie James Howard.
I think I need a lawyer, said Brandon.
Bailiff, please take Mr. Wall into custody, the judge said.
Jack watched in near disbelief as the bailiff cuffed Brandon on the witness stand. A silenced courtroom watched, riveted, as Brandon was escorted to the prisoner's exit, the side door that an hour earlier Jack's client had used to enter the courtroom.
Mr. Townsend, please rise, the judge said.
Jack stood beside his trembling client. The judge was looking straight at them, his expression stone-cold serious.
The defendant's request for pretrial release is granted, Judge Teague said. The state attorney's office has until 5 o'clock tomorrow to explain by written memorandum why the indictment should not be dismissed. By order of this court, Mr. Towson is released on his own recognizance without the requirement of bail. We are adjourned, he announced, ending the proceedings with a bang of his gavel. All rise, said the bailiff.
Jack felt his client leaning on him, almost unable to stand.
I'm out of jail,
Mark whispered.
Yes,
Jack said. Mark was on the verge of tears. Jack shared his client's relief, but it was hard to feel joy in a situation that remained tragic. On the other side of the courtroom, Jamal's parents looked numb, clinging to each other, struggling to work through the senselessness of it all. The judge retired to his chambers, and the media rushed to the rail.
Mr. Swiatek! Do you admit that your client is a racist?
Jack didn't respond. Instead, he let his client have a moment with his parents. But that first question from the media, and a slew of others that followed, was a quick reminder that it would take more than the dismissal of a murder indictment to find justice in this case. Jack had more work to do for his client. And for Willie James. Chapter 83. Andy was locked in battle as the driverless boat sped down the river. The pistol was in her grip, and with her other hand she tried to shove Colt's nose into his skull.
Colt twisted free and slammed her forearm against the wheel, but before he could gain control, the boat cut left at nearly 90 degrees, tossing them overboard. The gun flew out of Andy's hand and splashed into the river a split second before she did. The boat slammed into a tree on the river bank as she popped to the surface and gasped for air. Andy looked left and right, scanning the surface for any sign of Colt. He grabbed her from below and pulled her under. Andy kicked herself free, resurfaced, and then dived for her weapon. It was too dark in the depths to see anything, and the current had already carried them 50 yards downriver. The gun was gone. Colt surfaced like a breaching great white and came down on Andy. She clawed his face and kicked with her knees. He was on top, sucking air and water. Andy was below, getting water only. The current was taking them faster and faster downriver. Andy was inhaling water by the mouthful as they slammed into a buoy. Andy grabbed the chain that tethered it to the riverbed and kicked herself free. Colt continued alone downriver. The current was strong enough to give Andy a fight, but she held on. She saw Colt splashing ahead, his arms flailing. Andy glanced up at the buoy and immediately realized where they were. She'd studied the rivers for this assignment and had been warned about this stretch of the Santa Fe, where the river literally disappeared underground and didn't resurface for another 3 miles. A few swimmers and canoers had gone down here. None had ever been known to resurface downstream at River Rise Preserve State Park. Andy caught her breath, clinging tightly to the buoy, fighting through a pain in her kidney that was unlike any she'd felt before. She tried to ignore it, focusing her attention downriver. Colt waved his arms in one last act of desperation. Then he disappeared, sucked down into the dark, watery labyrinth of the Florida aquifer.
"Good riddance,"
Andy said, keeping an ear out for an FBI boat or helicopter, gritting out that pain in her lower left back, which wasn't getting any better. It was getting worse. Much worse. Chapter 84. Jack stopped at the courthouse steps, his client at his side as he delivered a very brief statement for a headline-hungry media. "We're grateful that the truth has come out. Mark Towson is not a murderer, and now the long journey begins to restore his reputation. We express our condolences to the cousin family and pray for the safe return of Percy Donovan. Thank you very much."
"Percy Donovan is alive and well," a reporter shouted. "Do you have any comment?"
Mark stepped forward.
"Thank God," he said.
"Thank you all," said Jack.
He could have said more, but he was content to let the media, every vestige of the media, grill the state attorney. Jack and his client caught a snippet as they struggled to make their way down the crowded courthouse steps.
"Mr. Bolt," a reporter shouted, "does this mean that the third croc, the burned one found in Bane Robinson's closet, was planted evidence?"
"Not at all," said the state attorney. "It turns out that the UF bookstore has sold over 10,000 pairs of gator blue crocs. So the fact that the charred remains of Mr. Robinson's crocs were the same color as the ones found on the river is no big coincidence. Funny, I know, but true."
Yeah, funny, thought Jack, as they kept walking. Fucking hilarious. The media followed him all the way to the curb. Mark's parents were in the front seat of the family car, waiting. He and Mark climbed into the back seat and closed the doors without another word. Oliver Bolt was still running his mouth on the courthouse steps, desperately trying to salvage his re-election, as the Towson car pulled away from the curb. No one said anything at first, as if Mark and his parents were still absorbing what had just happened. Then Mark had a question.
"What will happen to Brandon?"
he asked,
Jack likened it to a hazing prank gone horribly wrong. Involuntary manslaughter, I would think. A year in prison at worst. Probation if he's lucky. Same for any of the Alpha brothers who helped him. Jack's cell rang as they reached the intersection. It was Virginia.
Mr. Switek, would you have time to stop by Miss Porter's house today?
Sure, said Jack. What's this about?
I've been sorting through Miss Porter's things. I found something you might want to see. It has to do with Willie James.
Pine Avenue was a quiet, tree-lined street right around the corner from the courthouse. The houses were from a bygone era of porch swings and flower-filled window boxes. Bolt had clearly worked the neighborhood, with yard signs aplenty calling for the re-election of the state attorney. The Townsend family waited on the porch as Virginia took Jack into the parlor. He took a seat at Cynthia's antique secretary. Virginia laid an old file folder on the desktop in front of him.
"Where did you find this?" asked Jack.
"Upstairs," she said. "It was in a box in Miss Porter's closet with some other legal things."
Jack opened the file. Inside was a one-page document, typewritten. The E key bled too much ink, so holes blotted the paper like pips on a die. But the document was plainly legible. It was a sworn statement including witness attestations. The signatory was A. Philip Goff.
"That's Miss Cynthia's father," said Virginia. "Goff was her maiden name."
Jack noted the date at the top, January 2nd, 1944, and then read it. "On this day at 11 o'clock, two of my friends and myself went to the home of James Howard, where we found a colored boy by the name of Willie James Howard." It read very much like the letter Jack had received from Cynthia. Jack wasn't skimming, but the words seemed to float before his eyes, as if it were the resurrection of a terrible nightmare. "Took Willie James in the car with us. Drove to a place near Suwannee River. Tied the boy's feet and hands to keep him from running so his father could whip him." Jack stopped. It wasn't the first time he'd read about it, but seeing it in this format, an old sworn statement, made it almost unbearable. The boy making the statement that he would die before he would take punishment from his father or anyone else made his way to the river, where he jumped in and drowned himself. Jack gathered himself, then struggled through the next sentence. "His father stood by and viewed the son without preventing this happening."
"They made him watch,"
said Jack, barely able to say it.
"They took his father to the river and made him watch them drown his 15-year-old son."
Virginia stood in silence.
"This document,"
said Jack, disgusted. "This despicable lie that Willie James jumped in the river was clearly concocted by a lawyer."
"I'd like to know who..."
Virginia stopped him by placing another document in front of him.
"This was the cover letter that was in the file with the sworn statement."
Jack stared down at cream-colored stationery. It was from the same typewriter, the blotted E apparent in almost every other word. The engraved letterhead was in Old English. Jack read the masthead aloud. "Law Office of Oliver Bolt."
"His daddy,"
said Virginia. It was suddenly crystal clear why Oliver Bolt, Jr. wanted Willie James Howard to be no part of Mark Towson's hearing. Why he'd even gone so far as to tell the judge that there was no evidence that a Willie James Howard ever existed, let alone was lynched.
"Did Cynthia show this to the state attorney?"
I believe she did. I took her to his office. They talked in private.
How did that go?
She was pretty upset when she came out.
When was this?
About a week before she died.
Before she threw herself in the river. Jack was the last person to hold someone accountable for the sins of the father. But the cover-up, years and years of cover-up, was as bad as the crime.
Looks like the state attorney has even more explaining to do, said Jack.
Jack told the Towsons to head back to Gainesville without him. The state attorney's office was just a couple blocks away, and it took Jack less time to walk there than to ride the old Otis elevator from the lobby to the second floor.
Mr. Bolt is on the telephone, his secretary told Jack.
She said it again as Jack blew past her, and she repeated it several more times as she chased him down the hallway, too slow to stop Jack from entering unannounced. Bolt was at his desk, and he truly was on the phone. Jack dropped the file on his desk and flipped it open to reveal the letter from Oliver Bolt Sr.
Your father wrote this? Jack said, more of a statement than a question.
The state attorney stopped talking, still holding the phone as he examined Jack's personal delivery.
I'll call you back, he said, and then he laid the phone in the cradle.
His secretary was standing in the doorway, horrified.
That's all right, Janice, said Bolt. Hold my calls.
Yes, sir.
She closed the door on her way out, leaving the two men alone in the office.
How long have you known?
Jack asked in a tone that was less than cordial. Bolt glanced at his father's letter.
Too long.
This isn't the first lynching to go unpunished, said Jack. But there have been hundreds of atonement trials in this country. They're not just ceremonial. It's important to recognize the victim as a person and to call out the names of the murderers. Willie James Howard deserves that much.
Bolt didn't respond. Jack retrieved the file and tucked it under his arm.
I'm taking this to the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, said Jack, along with my request that they initiate an atonement trial.
Bolt stared down at his empty desktop a moment longer, then looked up.
Are you planning to do that before or after next Tuesday?
The question nearly set Jack back on his heels. The election was on Tuesday.
Rot in hell, Mr. Bolt.
Jack headed for the door.
Swatak,
said the state attorney. Jack stopped and turned.
I'm dismissing all charges against your client. Not only murder, but everything, including the text message. But I'm still charging Vane Robinson for sending that text. I think that's the just thing to do.
Jack tapped the file and said,
I'm still taking this to Montgomery before Tuesday.
I think that's the just thing to do. Jack let himself out, leaving as quickly as he arrived. The noisy elevator took him to the lobby and his cell rang as he exited the building. Jack continued down the sidewalk as he took the call.
Is this Jack Swiatek?
Yes, who's this?
I'm Special Agent Ferguson with the FBI.
Jack stopped. It was something he heard in Ferguson's voice.
I'm calling about your wife, Agent Henning.
Chapter 85.
Andy is in surgery.
The words registered, but everything else Jack heard from Agent Ferguson was a blur. Not until he hung up and started breathing again could he begin to think straight.
I need a car,
Andy had been airlifted by helicopter from the river to Shan's Hospital in Gainesville, 70 miles from Live Oak.